I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone. It's Kara Golden from The Kara Golden Show, and I'm thrilled to have our next guest here. We have Bismarck Lepe, who is the founder and CEO of Wiseline. And if you don't know what Wiseline is, you definitely need to hear all about it. And I'm so impressed with Bismarck. I actually met Bismarck as he was going through the EY Entrepreneurship Awards program. And which he'll talk a little bit more, I think, about as well. He was a finalist for the 2020 for Northern California. So really, really impressive. So he is so incredibly impressive that I had to reach out to him and get him on the podcast. And as I mentioned, he is with Wiseline, the company that he founded, but he's also the CEO of. And before that, he was part of what I kind of think of as the first batch of incredible soon-to-be entrepreneurs that left Google, ready to take on the world, or I should say, take the world by storm. And he did that. His first startup was a company, I'm probably not going to pronounce it exactly right, but Ooyala. So
it's perfect.
There you go. Which was an online video platform company that he built from zero to over $400 million exit. Incredible. And like I said, Wiseline is a company you should definitely know about. It's a global product development company that has kind of an interesting kind of differentiation there, that is the tech ecosystem of Guadalajara is involved in this. So we'll talk a little bit more about what Wiseline does to really help clients, and very, very excited to have you here, Bismarck.
Well, Kara, I'm incredibly excited to be here. And I was really excited when I saw your email when you reached out. You know, we had the opportunity to meet during the EY Entrepreneur of the Year event. And so I'm glad to hang out with another fellow Marin resident.
Yes, very, very cool. So let's get into a little bit about your background. Let's start at the beginning. So I'd love to get a picture of who Bismarck was as a kid. I mean, what did you know that you were going to be an entrepreneur?
So my parents are from a little village in Mexico, just outside of Guadalajara, kind of central Mexico. And they came to the U.S. as migrant field workers, but always had in place an importance on education. And so until I was seven, we would live between Mexico, Southern California, Central California, Washington State, and then back to Mexico every single year. And then when I turned seven, my parents felt that it was probably not going to benefit my academic career if we kept moving around. So we settled down in Southern California, and I grew up there. And my parents never had professional jobs, but as I mentioned, they placed an incredible importance on education. They told me, look, if you need tutors, if you need a computer, whatever you need, we'll work 2, 3, 4 jobs in order to be able to provide you with that. And sure enough, when I was in second grade, the year they made $13,000, they bought me a $3,000 computer. So I owe everything to them and their hard work and dedication.
That's amazing. Who did you think that you wanted to be when you grew up?
Well, it's funny. I learned to speak English, again, going with my parents. We spoke Spanish. Spanish is my first language. And I learned to speak English watching Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And so there was always this idea, and Dallas every now and then, which was probably, I shouldn't have been watching it with my parents, but that's what I was watching. Yeah. And all of these people were entrepreneurs. So I feel like I always have this bug to start something.
I love it. That's so great. So you, as you were growing up, you're in Southern California, you, I guess, decided that you were going to go to college and you ended up at Stanford. So that brought you up to Northern California and then ultimately ended up working at Google then. So share a little bit more about how you started thinking about, you know, after school. I mean, what were you going to be doing?
Well, I guess first and foremost, there was never a question whether or not I would go to college. My parents didn't understand what a state school versus a university versus a junior college, like they didn't understand how that worked. And when I got into Stanford, my mom was actually like, of course you got into Stanford. Like you're a top student, you're a great athlete, you're president of all these extracurricular activities. And I tried to explain to her, I'm like, it's kind of a big deal. It wasn't until like many years later that I think a lot of people were like, wow, your son goes to Stanford, that I think she realized, she's like, yeah, I feel kind of bad minimizing the fact that he got into Stanford. By the time my brother got in, it's like, oh, that's kind of a big deal. But when I, on my way to Stanford, again, one tries to mimic and copy the people that they know. And the person who was most successful that I knew closely is my uncle, or at the time was my uncle, who's an orthopedic surgeon, and he started a hospital in Manzanillo, Mexico. It's a little resort town, and he had done really well. His kids always had the best toys. So I'm like, well, he's done well. I'm going to go do well and do good and be a doctor. But I got to the Bay Area, to the Silicon Valley in 98, kind of with all of the excitement of the dot-coms and the internet. And I just fell prey to the capitalist machine that is the Silicon Valley. And so although I was going to school, I did switch my major. I majored in economics and studied computer science, but I really spent the majority of my time working at different tech companies, different startups. And one of those startups that I worked at was a company called Elance, and it shared two board members with Google, Ram Shriram and John Doerr. And when Google launched their advertising platform, they invited me to come in and be their first advertiser, their first customer. And so I ended up getting to know the company really, really well. And when I was about to graduate, they came to me and they said, hey, you should come work at Google. You know the platform better than our engineers and product managers. And I'm like, no, I think I'll stay at Elance. And they've treated me really well. I've been able to pay for school. And I used to go into the office at 2 o'clock in the morning and work until 9 a.m. and then go back to school from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and go back to the office. I'm like, they've been great. And the head of sales says, we're doing $650,000 of revenue a day with 96 employees. I'm like, you're right. I should go work at
Google. You should go there. And so what were you doing at Google then?
So I initially started off as a kind of a sales engineer, building tools for the big customers and the sales organization. And then I moved into the product organization, working on a lot of the monetization products. So initially, all of the ads that appeared on search results, and as Google's business got a little more interesting, image ads and eventually click-to-play video ads, which led me down the path of helping YouTube become monetizable after Google acquired YouTube in October of 2006.
Wow. Such an interesting time to be there, for sure. I mean, it's what sort of surprised you about, I mean, I'm just thinking about that time that you were there. I mean, what watching that company grow, to, you know, from the time that you started until the time that you left. I mean, what was probably the most surprising?
Well, you have to remember, my parents didn't come from the corporate world.
Yeah.
And so the only thing I knew about the corporate world was whatever I saw on TV. And so my growing up in the 80s, Wall Street, greed is good. And the best you can hope for is that you only have 20 years of being kind of at the bottom of the totem pole and other people treating you poorly. So eventually you can become that person on top of the totem pole to treat other people poorly. And I get to Google and it's completely different.
Yeah.
I was fed breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah. It was truly a meritocracy.
And
ideas
you had hint.
Come from everywhere.
Plenty of hint.
a lot of hint water. And it just changed my perspective. It changed my perspective so much that For a while there, I'm like, I just hope Google fails because this is not preparing me for the real world. The real world is not like this. But I think eventually I came to the realization that the real world is whatever you make of it. And what Google was doing in treating people well, allowing ideas to float up and become products and businesses from everywhere, is really the best way in order to run and build a fast-growing company. You need to push the decision-making out to the edges.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that you were there definitely at the right time. It sounds like a very, very exciting journey. So you left and you started your first startup, Ooyala. Did I pronounce it right?
You know, Ooyala is one of those names that was just not that great. And it's like, is it Ooyala? Is it Ooyala? Is it one of those things like, hey, your Ooyala is showing? Like, it was just not a good name, but we ended up with it and it worked out just fine. The origin story of the name was that it means cradle in Tagalog. Or Telugu, sorry, in Indian language. And we like the idea, like cradle of innovation. And my co-founder's girlfriend's like, no, it's like, it actually means swing bed and like swinging and like monkeys. And you guys are code monkeys. And I'm like, oh. And then we hired an early marketer and she's like, look, this is what we're going to say the origin story is of Ooyala. Yahoo had the double O's at the end. Google had them in the middle and Ooyala has them at the front. And there we are just the obvious connection point of all of those successful internet companies.
I love
it. So I think that's probably the one that is sometimes rare, but it wasn't the best name. But we started that company because we identified a problem when we were at Google. Again, at Google, it was fantastic because we got visibility into a lot of secular changes that were happening in pop culture and in business. And one of them was the idea of streaming. So Google acquired YouTube in October of 2006. Prior to Google acquiring YouTube, YouTube was the center of piracy. You could find anything and everything you could ever want on YouTube. And as a result, all of the media companies had come out publicly saying that they were going to sue YouTube. Viacom had a lawsuit for $1 billion. So Google acquires YouTube. Now Viacom has a lawsuit against Google for $1 billion. But what was interesting was publicly, Google was getting scrutinized for owning YouTube. But privately, we were holding meetings with the executives at all of those media companies, and they wanted to figure out how they could use and leverage YouTube as a promotional and marketing channel. And technically, they wanted to figure out how they could launch their own streaming service. Because back in 2006 and 2007, when we started Ooyala, like Netflix wasn't streaming, Apple wasn't streaming, nobody was streaming.
Right.
And so we identified that opportunity when we were at Google, and that's why we started Ooyala.
And who did you sell it to?
We ended up selling it to one of our strategic investors who came in 2012, Telstra. They're one of the biggest telcos in the world, primarily focused on Australia.
Oh, so interesting. And then you took a little time off, not too much, and decided to start Wiseline. So tell us a little bit about that.
So Wiseline, the name of the company is Wisdom of Crowds and Above and Below the Line. Hmm. So one of the things that I saw at Google was as the company grew, it became harder and harder to build products for the market because you inevitably had heads of sales in different regions who wanted something different for each one of their customers. The product teams felt like product direction should go in a certain way. Engineers maybe wanted to go and solve an interesting technical problem. And eventually, and this is very true for the entire software industry, between 60 and 90% of the software that is invested in, as in lines of code that are written, are going to products that are never used, never sold, or never completed. And so we saw that there was a lot of waste at Google. Google didn't really matter because Google figured out a legal way to print money. At Ooyala, we had the same problem, except we didn't have the little moneymaker. And it ended up really hurting the culture and it slowed down decision making. So the idea behind Wiseline was to build a platform that would help companies get better products to market faster by removing the ego of product prioritization and really focusing on the numbers. We used to say, you know, the numbers will set you free. So companies could build for markets and not individual customers or the opinions of individuals in the boardroom.
So interesting. And then the aspect of getting talent, and you have part of your company in Guadalajara. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in 2009, after we realized that we were going to survive, so we got very close within 3 days of running out of capital. But we signed a term sheet with a venture capitalist and invested $10 million, and it saved the company. But as we were going through the process of doing that round, we realized, all right, the VCs are going to start to invest again. And in the Silicon Valley, if you remember 2008, 2009, the economic crises, there weren't a lot of VCs that were writing checks.
Nope.
That said, Twitter was growing. Facebook was growing. Google had a lull, but was continuing to grow. Apple had released the iPhone at the beginning of 2007. And so they were starting to scale the business. And so it had been difficult during an economic downturn to hire and retain talent. We knew it was going to become impossible to do it once VCs started writing checks again. And so we hired a consultant to look at Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, South America, to set up an R&D center. And he came back and he said, you know what? Mexico's really interesting. I'm like, really? Why? You know, my parents left Mexico because they felt Mexico was dangerous, corrupt, zero upward mobility. And for them who came from a certain socioeconomic class that wouldn't have opportunities, they felt that the US would have a lot more opportunities for them. So for me, I initially questioned it, but I looked at the data. At the time, 60,000 engineers were graduating every year. Culturally, a lot closer to, you know, California, Silicon Valley culture than, you know, building teams in Eastern Europe or Southeast Asian countries, and also proximity. It's much easier and faster to get from San Jose to Guadalajara than it is from San Francisco to Bangalore.
Yeah.
And so we ended up going on a recruiting trip. And of the 15 engineers that we interviewed in Guadalajara, our CTO, who had zero connections to Mexico, said, you know, these eight are as good, if not better, than the engineers we worked with at Google.
That's incredible. Like, all right,
let's do this. And so at Uyala, we ended up building up an engineering team in Guadalajara. And one of the reasons that we were able to get the transaction, the exit for Uyala, was because we had built an aspirational brand, kind of Silicon Valley transplanted in Mexico. And they felt like we had a direct pipeline to talent. And so when we started Wiseline, we started with 100% of our engineers and team in Guadalajara, Mexico. We had more of the commercial product and design people in the Silicon Valley. And then eventually we moved into digital services. So not just helping with the product strategy, but also the execution. And then we just scaled incredibly fast in Mexico.
That's amazing. So what do you think has been the toughest part of managing a company when you've got, you know, two different countries that you're really dealing with? Is there, obviously, we're hopefully just coming out of the pandemic, I'm an optimist on that, but we'll see. What has kind of been the most challenging, I guess, especially over the last couple of years for you?
Well, I think because we started Wiseline with our entire engineering team in Mexico, in Guadalajara, and kind of the management team and salespeople in the US, we were remote from the start. Like, we were remote first. And so it required that we have the right tools in place. And so we started using Slack very early on. We were one of the early larger scale deployments of Google Hangouts at the time for video conferencing. But there were a lot of things that we needed to work on culturally, because we didn't want to be a Mexican company. We wanted to be a global company. And so there are certain cultural nuances that don't translate very well in Slack, and which I think is also kind of is one of the foundations of why DE&I has always been very important, because we've always felt like, and during our onboarding process, like we have an entire course on empathy. It's you need to understand that it's not what you say, it's what's understood and what's processed and what's heard. And so you need to really have insight into the culture of the people that you're speaking with. And I think that that empathy that we build into our own culture has also translated very well with our customers. So what your customer says isn't necessarily what they mean. And so you need to dissect it and really figure out, okay, you know, this customer needs this thing done because it's his job on the line.
Yeah.
And it's not, oh, wow, that customer is being really, really difficult. And so we, from day one, started remote first. And as we continue to build out our operations globally, I think we benefited from that. So today we have, you know, almost 1,500 Wiseliners in Mexico across 40 different cities. Our major hubs are Guadalajara, Mexico City, Querétaro. But we have a bunch of other cities with 40 or 50 Wiseliners. In Colombia, we have over 300 people. We're also in Spain, and we built out a delivery team out of Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam.
Wow.
So there, not only do you have the cultural aspects that you need to think about, you also have, you know, 16-hour differences.
That's incredible. Well, and I love the fact that, I mean, you're mentioning places where not many people are kind of pulling people from. I mean, for resources. So I think that that's an incredible aspect to your business too. So if people are listening, when would they reach out to Wiseline? I mean, when they're trying to think of an idea that needs to be worked on, I mean, when would Wiseline be the company that they wanted to, you know, reach out to get some help?
So a lot of companies that are in the technical engineering services business, they have this idea of a single engineer that works on an hourly basis. And when we moved into digital services, we started to model out what would a company that we would want to work with as a product company look like. And so we came up with this idea of a pod. A pod is 5 engineers. For every 2 pods, get a UX designer, technical writer, project manager. And the reason for a pod is because inevitably people get sick, people go on vacation, people leave the company. And so if you want predictability around delivering that product, you need, you know, there's safety in numbers. And we didn't charge by the hour. We looked at sprints because we wanted to give customers something very deliverable and tangible. And that's really the reason that the company grew very, very quickly. Over time now, we look at the entire life cycle of software development. And if a company's building technical solutions, there's a very high likelihood that Wiseline can help with the ideation and strategy process, product strategy, the development of the technology in the cloud. If they're trying to figure out how they can leverage data to build machine learning driven applications to have a more personalized experience, we can help with that. And we can also maintain applications. So once something has been built, do you really want your top-notch researchers continuing to maintain something that's kind of set it and forget it? We can help be that maintenance arm for your applications. And we work on a nearshore agile approach. And so we try to be in the same time zones as our teams, because we want every single person that's working on technology to be able to get on a Slack thread and work out issues and not make it more of a waterfall interaction process where you send something, you know, to India and then hope that it was interpreted correctly 12 hours later. And because we think that that matters, and we think that that's where the world is going.
No, it totally makes sense. And it's, no, I love that, because I think that that is a, you know, the concern when you're hiring engineers outside of your office, that it's, or outside of the, you know, the U.S., if you're a U.S. company, that you're looking for, you know, to make sure that there's some sort of connection there, that they're really going to understand what you're talking about. But in a time when it's hard to hire engineers too. So I think you're really solving problems for people that it makes a ton of sense. So one of the things that I found in talking to so many wannabe entrepreneurs is that, you know, they'll look at people like you who have come from Google, who have started, you know, multiple companies and everything turned out perfect. I mean, you talked a little bit about the 2008, 2009 time. I heard some pain in there while you were trying to figure out whether or not you guys were going to be able to make it. But I'd love to hear a story where you had a big challenge, you know, whether it's Wiseline or, you know, anything else that you've done too, where you really felt like, gosh, that was tough, but I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about business. I'd love to.
Well, it's always hard. And, you know, right now we have two other companies. One is Serbi, a security company that I'm a lowercase founder of that one with our former CTO from Wiseline and my younger brother, who was also a co-founder at Uyala. And this telehealth company that's targeting the U.S. Hispanic population that's leveraging the Wiseline business model, where you have doctors who act as health coaches in Mexico that provide services to the Spanish-speaking population in the U.S., and we have doctors in the U.S. If there's a handoff for prescriptions in persons or
oh, that's
or
amazing.
And the thing is, it's always hard. It's always difficult. The numbers are stacked against you. Your family, your health, your friends are all going to suffer. And that still doesn't guarantee success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we first started Uyala, there was a very large competitor in the space that had raised 100 times the amount of capital that we had raised. They were 200 times bigger than we were. And every day we would read press releases of a new big customer that they would sign. And, you know, as I would drive home at midnight, I would wonder, like, how in the world are we going to catch up?
Mm-hmm.
But by 6 a.m. the following morning, you needed to have a positive demeanor because you had people who were counting on you and you needed to deliver and you needed to work much, much harder. Now, the hardest part for me is when you are working that hard and there are these external forces that happen to you that you just cannot have an impact on. Like for us, it was the economic crisis. The good news is we had raised just enough money to survive just enough to get that next round of funding. But during that period, as the global financial markets collapsed, October of 2008, our board came to me and said, you know what? No one has seen this since 1929. And so I think we need to get a been there, done that CEO to help us navigate the waters. Like, okay, you guys are, and they were guys, two men. I'm like, well, you're the professionals. Okay, let's go through a process. And I started to interview candidates. But October of 2008, that year, 2008, our revenues were $300,000. So you can just imagine backdrop of the worst economic crisis since 1929 and a company that's only doing $300,000 in revenue. We weren't able to attract the best talent.
Totally.
So eventually I pushed back on the board. I'm like, look, this is just going to be a waste of time. We're not going to get great talent and we're probably going to run out of money in going through that process. They got really upset at me. Month over month, revenue improved. Quarter over quarter, revenue improved. And then around March of 2009, because we weren't yet profitable, I went out and started fundraise. And after the 50th no, like in 2008, we did $300,000 in revenue. In 2009, we did $3 million in revenue.
Wow.
But there was still so much uncertainty in the market that I couldn't get any VC to commit. And so I went back to the board and I'm like, look, the business is actually really, really good. The only thing we can change is the mouthpiece. So I'm like, I'd like to initiate the search for a CEO. And I don't know if it's imposter syndrome, but I felt like I needed to get someone who did not look like me. I wanted to get the prototypical cover of a Business Week mm-hmm. article mm-hmm. or Bloomberg article, right? Tall, full head of hair, white, look like a football player, look all American. And that's what I found. I ended up hiring this great executive, Jay Fulcher, who had been the CEO of Agile Technologies, had been the CEO as a public company, sold it to Oracle, all American. And he joined at about the 100th pitch to VCs. We continued to pitch. Eventually, we ended up getting about 170 no's. The 171st was the yes that saved the company. But it was, A, that process was hard. It was a lot of pitches, a lot of rejection. But the personal angst for me was, I had been the CEO. I no longer was the CEO. Okay, that happens. But then the biggest part and the hardest part for me was, I felt like I had let down all other founders and tech workers who looked like me, because there weren't a lot of Latinos in tech. And so my failure, I was assigning to the failure of everybody who looked like me. I'm like, oh, it's going to be less likely that VCs are going to trust another Latino coming in. That was tough. And I almost left Uyala. I ended up staying, and it was a great experience to learn from Jay how to manage the board, how to fundraise much bigger tickets, how to build out an enterprise sales team. But it was tough. It was really, really tough.
Well, and I think you took all of those learnings and went and did it again. And it's, you know, Wiseline is such an incredible company that probably, I always think, like, the journey that came before is always something that, you know, you are going to pick up pieces, whether that's, you know, who to allow to invest in your company, or in some cases, whether or not you're going to, you know, allow a new CEO to come in too. So I've had founders who have said that, you know, I just had Chip Wilson from Lululemon on, and, you know, he told an interesting story about when he decided to step down and had a new person come in, and you know, it was challenging. It was really challenging for him initially, but then it was challenging for the company. And at what point do you start to, you know, like, see whether or not it's going to work out or not? And what point do you sort of say, hey, we need to regroup? So there's a lot of different challenges that I think people, replacing yourself is definitely not easy, but I think it's sort of, you know, along the way, so many learnings, I think, for so many founders. So that's a really great one. So what has been the most rewarding part of starting Wiseline?
So I grew up poor, and I have absolutely no problem saying that the reason I was going to be a doctor was to make money. Again, the most successful person I knew, doctor, and that was my goal. Once I got to the Silicon Valley, I realized that there was another path. There were other paths to getting financial security. And then I was lucky enough to be Google pre-IPO. And when Google went public, I was still very junior. I got a lot of pre-IPO stock options, which are great. Not enough to go out and buy an island or retire or focus on just angel investing. But it did give me the security to go out and start a company and not need a salary. But after this push, this drive for my entire life of just getting to financial security was realized, I was at a bit of a loss. But then in 2010, when we were opening our operations in Guadalajara, Mexico, I realized that there was so much talent in Mexico, and obviously now the world, that wasn't able to tap into the same opportunities that I had had being in the Silicon Valley. And so for me, I feel like I had purpose again. And so this idea of, you know, some people call it conscious capitalism. I think of it as doing well and doing good.
Totally.
And so with Wiseline, one of the things that we've done, because we've scaled very quickly and we scaled in a country that wasn't on the forefront of everybody's, you know, decision-making criteria on this is where I'm going to set up a development center, we had to invest in the local community. And I really do feel like Wyzyme has been a key component of terraforming the tech ecosystem in Mexico. And how did we do it? And so about 4 years ago, we needed to hire 15 UX designers. And our head of UX had interviewed over 100 designers. She came back. She's like, look, none of these have an experience building applications that have, you know, 3 million concurrent video streams or 10 million uniques. I'm like, but are they good? She's like, yeah, some of them are pretty good. I'm like, do you think we can train them? Mm-hmm. And she's like, I don't know. I'm like, well, let's try it. And so we opened up the 6-week course, 6 nights a week, 4 hours a night. And we had about 300 people sign up for the program. We let 25 people in, 24 completed the program. We ended up hiring 15 of the 24. We saw that it worked really well. We tried it again for another skill set. And now we've expanded Wyzyme Academy, where we've taught over 40,000 people. And these are free programs, free, completely free programs. Everything from weekend courses on Alexa skill development to year-long paid apprenticeship programs for UX or data engineering. And that, to me, is what really drives me. I feel that through Wyzyme, we built a platform that, you know, it's a fantastic business. It's continuing to do well, but we're bringing more people into tech because talent is evenly distributed. Experience and opportunity isn't. And I think through Wyzyme, we're able to do that.
No, and you definitely are. Well, thank you so much, Bismarck. So where do people find out more about Wyzyme?
Wyzeline.com. And you can always email me, bismarck@wyzyme.com, BISMARCK, or you can follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Terrific. Well, I really enjoyed our conversation and I appreciate you making the time to do this. So thank you so much. And thanks everybody for listening and for subscribing to the Kara Golden Show too. Definitely give this podcast 5-star rating, or this episode, I should say. It definitely helps the algorithm. And just a reminder that I can be found on all platforms at Kara Golden. And if you haven't already picked up a copy of my book, Undaunted, shares a little bit more about the story of building Hint, definitely do that. And it's also available on Audible. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and now Friday. We just added another day because we have so many incredible founders and CEOs that we are interviewing and people who are sharing so many stories, failures, challenges along the way that I think just help all of us to learn. So thank you again, Bismarck. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a great rest of the week.
Thank you, Kara. Great honor, great pleasure.
Before we sign off, I want to talk to you about fear. People like to talk about fearless leaders, but achieving big goals isn't about fearlessness. Successful leaders recognize their fears and decide to deal with them head on in order to move forward. This is where my new book, Undaunted, comes in. This book is designed for anyone who wants to succeed in the face of fear, overcome doubts, and live a little undaunted. Order your copy today at undauntedthebook.com and learn how to look your doubts and doubters in the eye and achieve your dreams. For a limited time, you'll also receive a free case of Hint Water. Do you have a question for me or want to nominate an innovator to spotlight? Send me a tweet at Kara Golden and let me know. And if you like what you heard, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow along with me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Kara Golden. Thanks for listening.